G'day, Indy Wood here. You're listening to The Local Update, a podcast about local issues and events taking place around the Bega Valley. Produced by Indy Media, you can find all the info you need about who we are at indymedia.com.au. This week on the show, we will travel to the community of Candalow on the far south coast of New South Wales, a creative community that is being heavily impacted by these isolation times as a result of COVID-19. And we'll catch up there with local resident Sam Martin. As I said, my name's Indy Wood. Thank you for your company today. And as we do every week, we'll start things out, though, by catching up with local historian, member of the Bega Pioneers Museum, Mr. Graham Farram.
I was speaking about the Railway Junction Hotel at Woolloomla, Henry Parks. Let's have a railway down here. I also mentioned the German wagon. It got a mention in Charles Henry Souter's Harvest Time poem, when the cranky German wagon with its 10 or 15 baggin. Tie these two things together today. I'm quoting from Australia Unlimited by James Edwin Brady, known as Ted to his friends. I managed to get this from the National Library of Australia, and I took down two pages. It's a big fat book. I'm on page 271 and 272, and it's the chapter called The Land of Milk and Honey. Edward Brady's going around the country describing the prospects of various places. And he's just been in Eden and spoken about whaling there, which might come up again when we look at Alice Otten. But I'm going to move on from Eden a little bit inland. It says here on page 271, Eden of today is a haunt of tourists and a shipping depot for timber and wool and produce brought down tediously by teams from Monaro and the adjoining districts. Midway between Melbourne and Sydney, this fine harbour, as the terminus of a railway from the tableland, should have a future. At Kaya, Toowoomba, Perico, Yambla, Nungatta and Nethercote, there are good farmlands, some in settlement and some awaiting subdivision. The hills will grow splendid fruit, and though old in as Australian occupation goes, the district is still young in development. On a blithe, windy morning, we went out to Nethercote, a belt of volcanic soils a few miles from Eden. En route, we halted the German wagon of one Adolf Porter at the summit of a tall forested hill. Now, this is actually the German wagon that we have in the Bega Valley Historical Society's Pioneers Museum, and it's well worth a look. Pine, hardwood, got some colours on it, Lutheran colours. A lot of that's faded away. Back to page 272. Adolf is a fine example of a successful Bavarian colonist, blue-eyed, blonde-bearded, hearty and cheerful. With his competent Australian wife and three stalwart sons, he has cleared and cultivated a comfortable farm out of virgin forest. It was called Model Farm. There's photographs of that at the museum too. He holds a 250-acre block under conditional purchase title. 21 years ago, he began as a young immigrant on 91 acres. He had a little colonial experience and no capital. As he cleared the heavy timber, he planted maize and potatoes. After a few years, he began dairy farming. By culling his little herd and testing his milk carefully, he can make his cows each return him as much as £2.03 and 9 pence monthly per annum. He nets nowadays a living of £300 a year and regards Australia as a good country. Nethercote soil averages 40 to 50 bushels of maize to the acre. In good years, the crop can go up to 90 bushels. Its farming population seems exceptionally contented. We turned northward by inland roads, climbing over the hills that lie between Pambula and Wyndham, and crossing Myrtle Mountain en route to Candler. We might go to Candler with Ted on another day. But one person who did go to visit Ted Brady at Mallacoota, where he had a property down there, was Henry Lawson. I'm looking at a book from the library now called The Songs of Henry Lawson with music, compiled by Chris Kempster. It's an introduction by Manning Clark, who, of course, lived down here on the coast for many years, to Viking O'Neill, Penguin, 1989. The Dewey number is 780.994 Chem. It's called The Bar in this book and dated to 1910. Friends contriving to ease Lawson out of his drinking rounds took him in 1910 to where his friend and fellow writer E.J. Brady was camped at Mallacoota in Victoria. There in the bush, among friends, he wrote this and other poems. This version is taken from Poetical Works of Henry Lawson, 1925. It's published under the title Mallacoota Bar, as far as I can remember in that particular edition. Of course, to go into Mallacoota, you needed a small boat. He was travelling by steamer from Sydney, get off at Eden, pick up a small boat there, or go overland, bit of a trek overland, but with a small boat, you could do it. And here he is trying to get out of Mallacoota. We tried to get out of the bar today on the morning tide. And whether I go or whether I stay, let fate and the bar decide. But my love, new love, with your eyes of grey, the weary world is wide. We catched her back, and we poled her back, in time for the ebbing tide, for the sky was grey and the rocks were black and the rollers broke outside. And it's, oh, my love, but the lines are slack, and the weary world is wide. We tried to get over the bar tonight on the highest tide. But the moon is dull, and last night was bright, and the world is dark outside. Oh, love, new love, why is your face so white and the weary world so wide? We tried to get over the bar today. Tomorrow we'll try again. Oh, love, new love, the grey eyes say, is the stripe of man in vain? The glass must lie, and the needles stray. But the path of love is plain. When over the bar, there is no return in the time of the August gales, autumn gales, excuse me. But whether the sea or the bush it be, the heart of man prevails. Oh, love, new love, you may watch the sea where your bushman sailor sails. Sorry about that little slip in there. But yes, here we are in autumn, and I was going to do some autumn poetry, but I might save that for next time. Being at home, being able to look over my library, I find things. I find doubles of this and doubles of that, having been a bookseller. If it was a good book and I ever saw it out there, I'd buy it. So I ended up with two copies of one book, which I'm going to quote from. I've heard some talk of people saying, you know, oh, keep a journal, write up a diary, good thing to do. And it is. All of these times make for very interesting expressions in writing. And I think of the Diary of Anne Frank. I think of The Log of the Sea of Cortez by John Steinbeck, an expedition that he made into the Gulf of Mexico. That's a brilliant book. Of course, Cook's Journal. I'll quote a bit of that at some time when I get a chance. But the book that I found or books, the same book, but different, two different editions, is called The Diary of a Nobody. And I thought, oh, yeah, that'll do. So fiction, this has gone into fiction. I was thinking of Daniel Defoe and Robinson Crusoe. Now, there's a person who was in isolation, Alexander Selkirk, I think his real name was. And Defoe also wrote Journal of the Plague Year. And when that first came out, people thought it was actually somebody who'd written down what it was like to be in the plague in London in the about 100 years previous to him writing it. So he's a very good writer. But this one's called The Diary of a Nobody by George and Whedon Grossmith. And from the introduction here by J.C. Squire, I'll just read the first paragraph. The Diary of a Nobody, the greater part of which originally appeared as a serial in Punch, was written by two brothers, of whom one was best known to the public as an actor and the other as an entertainer. No one ever thought of comparing them with Flaubert or Gissing, whom they very likely had not read, and the day of Chekhov had not yet arrived. About 1890 sometime this book written. Yet it is arguable that in point of mere realism of fiction, they came as near to the truth as any of their more celebrated and more somber contemporaries. It is true that their temperament gave their work a comic bias, as the temperament of most of the realists gave theirs a gloomy bias. But if any man really wants what the critics used to call a slice of life, here it is. After the introduction, there's a short note by the author, or the fictional author, Charles Pooter. He addresses the Laurels, Brickfield Terrace, Holloway, of course, in England. And he says, "Why should I not publish my diary? I have often seen reminiscences of people I have never even heard of, and I fail to see, because I do not happen to be a somebody, why my diary should not be of interest. My only regret is that I did not commence it when I was a youth." Well, I read it from cover to cover, and I read it many years ago as a youth myself. But I found a couple of entries here that I thought were quite droll. This one is dated December the 18th. Now, that actually happens to be my wedding anniversary. So I thought, oh, what now, what's that? And it says, "Yesterday I was in a retrospective vein. Today it is prospective. I see nothing but clouds, clouds, clouds. Lupin is perfectly intolerable over the Daisy Mutler business. He won't say what is the cause of the breach. He is evidently condemning her conduct, and yet, if we mention to agree with him, says you won't hear a word against her. So what is one to do? Another thing which is disappointing to me is that Carrie and Lupin take no interest whatever in my diary. I broached the subject at the breakfast table today. I said, I wasn't hoped that, if anything ever happened to me, the diary would be an endless source of pleasure to you both, to say nothing of the chance of the remuneration which may accrue from its being published. Both Carrie and Lupin burst out laughing. Carrie was sorry for this, I could see, for she said, I did not mean to be rude, dear Charlie, but truly, I do not think that your diary would sufficiently interest the public to be taken up by a publisher. I replied, I am sure it would prove quite as interesting as some of the ridiculous reminiscences that have been published lately. Besides, it's the diary that makes the man. Where would Evelyn and Peach have been if it had not been for their diaries? Carrie said I was quite a philosopher, but Lupin, in a jeering tone, said, if it had been written on larger paper, Gov, we might get a fair price from a butterman for it. As I am in the prospective vein, I vow the end of this year will see the end of my diary. Well, of course, that didn't happen. and it went on into the new year. Various things happened, and I thought this was rather good. I've got to April the 29th now. The book runs on for a little bit after that, but I thought this was quite good. April the 29th, just about now. I'm getting quite accustomed to being snubbed by Lupin, and I did not mind being sat upon by Carrie because I think she has a certain amount of right to do so. But I do think it hard to be at once snubbed by wife, son, and both my guests. Yeah, this gentleman's name is Gowing. But I guess if I say it as Going, you might get the impression of his two friends. So Going and Cummings had dropped in during the evening, and I suddenly remembered an extraordinary dream I had had a few nights ago, and I thought I would tell them about it. I dreamt I saw some huge blocks of ice in a shop with a bright glare behind them. I walked into the shop, and the heat was overpowering. I found that the blocks of ice were on fire. The whole thing was so real and yet so supernatural, I woke up in a cold perspiration. Lupin, in a most contemptuous manner, said, "What utter rot!" Before I could reply, Gowing said there was nothing so completely uninteresting as other people's dreams. I appealed to Cummings, but he said he was bound to agree with the others, and my dream was especially nonsensical. I said, "It seems so real to me." Gowing replied, "Yes, to you, perhaps, but not to us." Whereupon they all roared. Carrie, who had hitherto been quiet, said, "He tells me his stupid dreams every morning, nearly." I replied, "Very well, dear. I promise you I will never tell you or anybody else another dream of mine the longest day I live." Lupin said, "Hear, hear," and helped himself to another glass of beer. The subject was fortunately changed, and Cummings read a most interesting article on the superiority of the bicycle to the horse.
Graham Farram is a long-term resident of the Bega Valley. He's the former proprietor of Mumford's Books here in Bega, a known artist as well, and has been a long-term member of the Bega Pioneers Museum. We catch up with him every week to find out what treasures he's found from his collection. Some of the industries most impacted by the COVID-19 lockdown would be those creative industries, such as theatre, comedy, and music, with many workers in that industry operating in what's now known as the gig economy. They're not exactly casual workers, because they can work for different employers all over the world and fly from city to city performing their tasks, such as setting up stages, operating festivals, making sets, and doing the sound engineering at concerts. Lots of them even work for themselves. All of these workers have been left completely out of the loop as far as Josh Frydenberg's financial support packages. In this region, the community of Candalow is known as a bit of a creative hub, with artists like David Ross MacDonald and the boys from the Gadflies recently making the Candalow community home. Sam Martin and his family have been in that community for about 15 years now, and he tells me the isolation has seen him lose an average of 2 gigs a week, and his family's finances have been significantly impacted by this lockdown.
Yeah, it's noticeable. Like, for me, I'd say it's probably an average of around $400 per week that I've lost in income. And that's kind of, you know, it's a bit hard to work it all out. But yeah, I've had a bit of a tough year with the bushfires as well, because that sort of slowed us right up to shows during summer.
How much of an impact are you seeing within Candalow from this event?
Well, Candalow, you know, it certainly is a hub for creative people who come and create here. And I think that the COVID-19 impact is that there's more people possibly creating more, because there isn't much else to do, as in presenting or producing shows or all of that other sort of stuff that goes along with it. So I think that from the creative side, there's probably people doing a lot of deep thought and playing music out there. And, you know, the thing that we're sort of missing in Candelo is that, you know, that scene of going and putting on shows at the town hall and being able to all get together as a community and get a bush dance and connect like that. So, you know, it is a bit of a sort of a holiday away from that regular thing that happens in Candelo. But I think that from a creative point of view, there's probably still a lot of creative work going on, a lot of people composing work, a lot of people maybe looking at different ideas and ways of expressing themselves in a creative way, which, you know, we're seeing a lot of that happening online these days. And yeah, so I'm not exactly sure. I mean, we'd probably run a gig a month as a part of the Candelo Arts Society, and then there'd be others around that, and those things have certainly been impacted. But beyond that, I think that there's still a lot of sort of creative juices flowing in the valley for sure.
Have you found other ways of pushing that creativity within yourself in an online environment or whatever as a part of this?
Yeah, I've been recently, the last few years, I've actually put a fair bit of focus into running a market stall at the Candelo Markets once a month, and just going down there, and I sort of, you know, organise myself as a little community garage sale where I pay all of the insurances and set the stall up, and people can drop their little cardboard box of things down to me for me to sell during the day. And so what I've ended up doing is, because I've had a bit of a spell on the gigs and there hasn't been much work as far as that's concerned, I've put a bit more energy into being creative around that market stall, and I've sort of started an online business called Refuse Revival, which is all about saving things from going to landfill. So, you know, I'm very proud of the fact that my market stall is like the last stop before the tip. And so, you know, a lot of people are coming with donated goods who are like, I don't want this, but someone might. And so I've been creating little online videos for YouTube, which is based on all of that. It's about reusing and making the most of everything until it's basically at a compostable state. So things like building a garden bed, one that I've done recently. I've just done another one on creating a audio input for your iPhone so that you can get sort of high quality sound into your iPhone without using the internal mics that are on board an iPhone. And I was building that using just bits of an old headphone set and some sort of cables that I had lying around. And also I've just done one today which was on building compost and how I go about making compost. So I'm putting energy into that sort of stuff. I'm not playing or writing as much music, but I just think, well, it's okay to have a break from that and throw my energy somewhere else.
Have you thought at all about what this is going to mean if this event extends for a longer period, like a year or two?
What it's going to come down to is really appreciating the small things in life and making the most of what we have. And so that's kind of where my focus is just look for the positive in any experience. And if you can focus your mindset around that, then hopefully, you know, we'll come out of these things in a better shape than we went in.
Do you see the model of the Candelo Arts Society morphing and changing to try and fit this in somehow?
Look, I think the model of the Candelo Arts Society has always been a morphing and changing thing around energy and people. And so, you know, I've been involved in the Arts Society since I came here to Candelo, and particularly heavily involved in the last 10 years, and have been coordinating the festival that we run every couple of years and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, recently I've sort of taken a little bit of a step back off that kind of day-to-day organisation of the body, and it's had a new life come in Tamalyn, who's an amazing president, and Laura's come on as secretary. And so the whole art society is having a bit of a shift anyhow, and those guys bring a bit of those skills, so especially the online skills. So yeah, we might see something interesting come out of that. I certainly hope so. You know, I'm not exactly sure. At the moment, it's sort of on a bit of a break and a bit of a sort of wait and see what happens. So we've sort of just had to cancel cancel all of our shows for the foreseeable future. And I think that as we go into this and deal with the issues arising from the coronavirus, once we've sort of come to a place where we understand what it's like to live so separate, I'm sure we'll work out ways to reconnect and form a community bond through something like the Arts Society.
Have you talked to others in the creative industries around Candelow about the impact that it's having on them?
Oh, a little bit. You know, I think everyone's just kind of hands up in the air and just like, well, there goes all our plans. I mean, we had a group of us organised to go and do some shows on the just a little further up the coast in Naruma and Maria a few weeks ago, and we had to pull the pin on that. And that was sort of just in the lead up to Australia choosing to shut down. And we, you know, we decided to pull on that. And so there was a little bit of discussion around that. I think that, you know, it's certainly tragically hard for some of the creative people that rely on income from doing shows and being a part of shows. And that's where I think it's going to hurt and does hurt a few of, you know, my friends locally and nationally who are, you know, unable to work now because they can't. Their whole job is about communicating something to many people. And so they're having to come up with some pretty creative ideas to try and source some income. And, you know, like there's a lot of things like happening. An example is there's like a national T-shirt day where, you know, you're encouraged to go online and buy a band's T-shirt and those sorts of things. So, yeah, I think that, you know, artists are definitely people who are creative and resourceful, and when they need to be, they will find a way.
Is our government doing enough? How do you respond to the suggestion from Josh Frydenberg that he had to draw the line somewhere on financial support?
Yeah, I don't think it's done enough for the arts community because there's so much involved in the arts community more than, you know, there's the creative inputs that composers and music and songwriters do and create, and there's also, and those performances, but there's also the, you know, the technical side of it, all of our sound engineers and lighting technicians, all of our producers, stage managers, all of these people are in very casualised employment sort of things, which is, you know, it's just the nature of the industry is that I've got a gig here in Adelaide and then I've got to fly over, I'm doing one in Brisbane, and you're working for different companies all the time. And I think, you know, not thinking of those sorts of workers in the job seeker handouts is it's a bit detrimental to the industry for sure. And, you know, I know that you have to put things through in a rush, but, you know, I think that there was definitely call for that sort of thing to happen and be in there. I wouldn't envy being in Josh Frydenberg's position for sure and having to work out how that, you know, all gets funded. But I do think that, you know, there just needs to be support for anyone who really needs it.
Is there a way that you know of that we can support the Candelow community or artists from around this region if we're in a position financially to do so?
Go to the artist direct and, you know, if they've got something on their website that they're selling, well, then just go ahead and buy it because every dollar's going to count for them.
Sam Martin is a musician and teacher based in Candelow. The Local Update is a podcast produced in the Bega Valley by Indie Media, a podcast looking at local issues and events from around the community. You can find all the info you need about who we are and what we do at indiemedia.com.au. Thank you again to Sam Martin for his time and to Graham Farram, of course. We'll catch up with Graham next week, as we do each week here on The Local Update. My name's Indy Wood. Thank you so much for your time. Bye now.